Hello, it's Wednesday, October 25th, and you're listening to Wing Radio. I'm Lisa Giuliani.
And I'm Victor Thorne. Welcome to Wing TV. We're very pleased to announce that we're having Mr. James Petras on our show today. He's the author of a recently released book called The Power of Israel in the United States. And we know this is a very controversial subject, as two professors a couple months ago got in a lot of hot water for publishing an article about the nation of Israel. But before we bring Mr. Petras on, I'd like to give a brief introduction. He is a professor emeritus at Binghamton University in New York, and I'm very familiar with this area because we used to go to the NASCAR races every year up in Watkins Glen. It's a beautiful part of the country. He's also the author of 62 books. That's right, 62 books that have been published in 29 languages. He has articles published in the New York Times, The Guardian, The Nation, The Christian Science Monitor. He's won several awards, including the Lifetime Career Award from the American Sociology Association. And best of all, he taught right here in Happy Valley at Penn State University from 1967 to 1972. And anyone that teaches at Penn State has to be a good guy. So we'd like to welcome Mr. James Petras to Wing TV.
Hi, James.
How you doing, James?
Oh, fine. Greetings to Happy Valley.
Yes, we talked a couple days ago on the phone about it, and it seems like you remember this area quite well. So.
Oh, yes. Belfort, Lamont.
Exactly, yes.
All the neighboring villages.
Right. Well, I'm glad you remembered. Well, James, before we start, tell everybody a little bit about this most recent book of yours, The Power of Israel in the United States. And I know we carry it here on Wing TV now, but tell everybody how they can find a website, how they can order through you, whatever kind of information you want to give.
Well, the book itself is based on my research of 5 years, beginning before the Iraq War, but especially stimulated by the organization of the war and the main proponents. In the late 80s, I was very struck by the fact that some of the most prominent authors of a paper, the Project for New America, were also advisors to the Israeli state, particularly the right-wing government of Netanyahu.
Uh-huh.
And these same people then became part of the Bush administration in key positions, particularly in the Pentagon, National Security Council, people like Wolfowitz, number two, after Rumsfeld, Douglas Feith, number three. You had people like Elliot Abrams in the National Security Council on the Middle East. You had Libby, who was a protege of Wolfowitz,
uh-huh,
who was in the vice president's office. You had Frum, who was, all these people are prominent Zionist fanatics for Israel. Frum was Bush's speechwriter on the Axis of Evil, another right-wing extremist Zionist, and I could run down the list, and that was inside the government.
Right.
And outside the government, you had the American Israel Political Action groups and the AIPAC,
uh-huh,
organization that has over 100,000 members and a budget of close to $90 million that has the congressmen frightened, wetting their pants that they should object to anything,
yeah,
on any issue on Israel. So here you have the Congress, you have the executive, and you have the bias in the mass media, including public radio, that always presents a pro-Israel slant.
You're exactly right. Well, let me ask you this question. I read an article the other day about Israel's invasion of Lebanon, and it described how after the initial shock and awe of their airstrikes, Israel thought that they'd roll right through Lebanon. But the Hezbollah had this intricate network of underground bunkers, information systems, and these counterinsurgency plans. Plus, they even utilized some guerrilla techniques that they learned from Vietnam and even World War II. So my question is, what did this defeat, or at least a stalemate, do to the superiority complex of the IDF as well as the leadership of the Israeli government?
Well, clearly this was a political setback, if not a military setback. and usually act with impunity. They bombed Iraq's nuclear station. They invaded Lebanon three times, going all the way up to Beirut in 1982. They've been slaughtering Palestinians. They're still slaughtering them 7-8 a day. So they're used to being the bully on the block, and they're pushing this and aggressiveness thumbing their nose or sticking their fingers in the eyes of anybody that cites international protocols, the Geneva Agreement, uh-huh. United Nations resolutions. So this is a big setback because none of that took place. In the final instance, they had to face their own dissent in their own country over what this war was all about, and they went through this whole process of who lost the war in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. And needless to say, none of that debate led to any rectifications in the direction of a more a peaceful foreign policy. Most of the critics argue that Israel should have been more brutal. I guess arguing right. that a million cluster bombs dropped on Lebanon was not enough.
Right. Yeah. You point out in your book, James, that influential U.S. politicians make these annual pilgrimages to Israel and profess their loyalty to the Israeli state, even while Israel goes on committing genocide of Palestinians and engages in this Lebanon Holocaust. You further go on to say that rather than reprimanding Israel and withdrawing our support and the United States moving to stop Israel's aggression and human rights violations, we applaud them. Our government applauds these crimes, this terrorism, and opposes an international mediation to prevent further Israeli massacres. What has the United States government done with respect to U.S. American credibility on the international stage?
Well, it's resulted. Israel is a pariah state in the world. Very, very, very few countries outside of the U.S. and Europe look to Israel as a democracy. Most look at it as a theocratic dictatorship of a minority over a majority of Arabs. And so the fact that the U.S. associated itself with the colonial regime is totally anachronistic. I mean, colonialism as a form of external control went out in the 50s, and now if Europe, the United States, exercise power, it's through its multinationals, it's through enticing or blackmailing or influence domestic governments, but hardly occupying countries, which is exactly what we're doing in Iraq. And we're ending up in the same boat as Israel, as a pariah state, as someone that keep at arm's length. And I think this is one of the big negative outcomes for the United States. It's lost its aura of being a country in favor of democracy and self-determination, and has become essentially viewed as another one of these colonial powers like Israel. And identity between U.S. politics and Israel is very damaging, particularly for the U.S. business in the Middle East. And this is one of the things that the book is addressed to, is this hogwash that the left in the United States or the progressive or anti-war movement keeps citing big oil.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I've looked up in all the journals, interviews with big oil representatives, PR people, and I don't find any evidence that they were involved in any way in fashioning the policy or implementing it or benefiting by the Iraq war. Maybe down the line, when a new regime comes in, they'll be able to sign some oil contracts in the region with Iraq or possibly Iran, but that has not been the case. And it's by that process of elimination that I honed in on the Zionist phenomena.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I want to continue on in this and frame this question in regard to the situation that we have this potential upcoming war with Iran that everybody's talking about. And in your book, you say that what we see in Washington, D.C. is a split. On one side, you have all of those people who are influenced by the pro-Israel lobby, all the different lobby groups and the senators and the neocons and so forth. On the other side, then, you say you have individuals from the Pentagon, the State Department, a few congressmen, and most of the active and retired servicemen who are definitely opposed to going into Iran. So my question is, and I realize this is a complex situation, but in your opinion, how is this all going to shake out?
Well, one thing I'm extremely concerned about is the coming to congressional power of the Democrats. People like Charles Schumer and Hillary Clinton are fanatical pro-Israelites.
Right.
They've even stated the interests of Israel are the interests of the United States.
Right.
65% of the funding of the Democratic Party comes from rich Jews. And these people are pushing the Israeli agenda, as they always do. Remind me of the old Soviet Union. It did pass the line, and the local parties carry it out. And this phenomena with Iran is extremely serious, and it could lead to thousands of U.S. boys being killed for Israel's expansionist interest in the Middle East, and it's the elections are not going to help the peace process. My reading of the Democratic Party, at least that part that seems dominant. I mean, there's a fellow that's running the Democratic congressional funding who is himself been active in Israel during wartime, and he runs the funding of 20 of the 22 Democrats he's funding are all pro-war Democrats, obviously.
Unbelievable.
Fanatical pro-Israel. And Charles Schumer, who should be called a senator from Tel Aviv, is in charge of funding the senators. So we can't expect anything from the Democratic Party, despite the fact you have a congressman in Mirtha in Pennsylvania who's speaking out for American service people,
right,
and to American people and saying, let's get out of Iraq and let's not get involved with Iran.
You lay it out.
I think this is the big question. Who are we fighting these wars for, Israel or for our own national interests?
We've asked the same question.
Yeah.
You lay it out very well in your book about this Jewish-funded political action committee funding that affects both parties. The Democrats, you say, citing Richard Cohen from the Washington Post, 60% of their financing comes from the Jewish lobby. The Republicans, 35% financing. Now, if almost all of this lobby's fundraising focuses on a single issue, which is unconditional knee-jerk support of Israel, its policies, its land grabs, its institutions, etc., how much of this money that's being given to these action committees to go to the lobby from U.S. taxpayers is actually subsidizing a foreign power? And how much of that money gets funneled back to the lobby that goes to Israel?
That's a good question, and I was not able to answer it. I'm not sure if some of these U.S. businesses, Jewish-owned businesses that get contracts in Israel, aren't the conduit for these recycling American aid back to the lobbyists in the United States. However, I want to add one thing. Given the high proportion of Jewish billionaires and, of course, millionaires, it wouldn't be hard to fund many of these lobbies, pro-Israel lobbies, merely on the bank accounts of the local American Israeli supporters in this country.
That's a good point. Now, James, we always hear this spin from the neocons and President Bush, and they say they want democracy for the people of Iraq. But if you ever speak to a real neocon or to an Israel firster, you realize that these guys not only hate the Arabs and the Muslims. They despise them. They truly hate these people. So when it comes to Iraq, to the Iraqi invasion, what are our real reasons for being there, especially now that it's become such a disaster?
Well, obviously, you don't engage in a colonial invasion to bring about democracy. Democracy comes, as we know in the United States history, from revolutions, from civil war that we had against the slavocracy, against the colonial. It comes from the civil rights movement, the grassroots organizing, and all history teaches us that colonial invasions lead to oppression. They lead to the kinds of mass killings and starvation and horrors, as the Lancet, the British Medical Journal, points out, over 600,000 Iraqis have died since the U.S. invaded. So you don't build the democracy in cemeteries. And I think that never was taken serious. I don't think any neocon or whatever, Zioncon, as I call them, are so stupid to believe that. What they used was this rhetoric, and then, of course, most of the media took it up and called them idealists or whatever, said that these were false goals, as if they were to be taken serious instead of a very thin varnish on essentially a military endeavor to eliminate Israeli adversaries in the Middle East. Iraq provided, Saddam Hussein provided pensions for all the Palestinians, the families of Palestinians who fell in resisting Israeli encroachments. They provided humanitarian aid, hospitals, and other welfare programs to support the Palestinian efforts to oust the Israeli occupiers. You could say a lot of things about Saddam Hussein's repression inside the country and some of his brutal methods, but one thing you could not accuse him of is lacking international solidarity with other oppressed Arabs, particularly the Palestinians, and that's what the war was all about. Israel doesn't want anybody in the Middle East that can challenge their dominance in the region.
Right, right. We said it before, they don't want a balance of power in the Middle East. Let's get to this paper that was penned by Douglas Feith and Paul Wolfowitz. They are known to be responsible for the evidence that was fabricated about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which was the bogus reason we were all given to go over there and occupy Iraq. They authored this policy paper, you say, in 1996 for Likud Party extremist Benjamin Netanyahu, entitled A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm. And it called for the destruction of Saddam, the overthrow and destabilization of governments of Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. Tell everybody a little bit about this paper, and supposedly they bypassed the Mossad in going into Iraq, Mossad intelligence?
I don't believe that. They float stories all the time. Who is they? I mean, the Israeli...
Our government?
Government is... A large part of their foreign policy is coordinated with the Mossad. That's the same business about the CIA being a loose cannon in the U.S. government. You have the National Security Council meetings where the CIA, the Pentagon, the State Department all meet, discuss policy, and they wrangle and discuss who takes primary roles in what time and what period. But on the basic issues, the big issues, they are all in agreement. There's no way that the Mossad did not know, was not privy to the discussions and preparations to that war. That is folklore. That's the kind of stories they tell little kids when they're about 2 or 3 years old.
Yeah, I read it in
about
your book.
Tooth fairies. I mean, Mossad is involved. Mossad may have done a crummy job in intelligence, and there's a lot of mediocrities in the Israeli government, apart from felons like the president of Israel, accused of raping and abusing scores of women in his in and out of office. But one thing you can say is they know when they're going to invade a country.
Yeah, and we just posted articles about that president and his little Bill Clinton-esque type of things. Now, James, we've heard the wailings about the Holocaust for 60-plus years now, but there's very little mention in the mainstream media, the Jewish-controlled mainstream media, about what's happening in the Middle East, the genocidal activities directed towards the Palestinians, those in the Gaza Strip, and in Iraq. Tell us a little bit about Israel's final solution in the Middle East.
Well, the final solution is this. They're starving the Palestinian people. They blocked off their trade routes. They've destroyed their orchards, the farmers, the olive trees. They've blown up their power plants, destroyed the roads, telecommunication systems. They've arrested the elected government. What, in effect, they're trying to do is starve the people into leaving, which is what Ariel Sharon said they would do. He said, create conditions that will make likely the voluntary departure of the Palestinians. And I think that he's made it clear, and he's made it clear about who makes U.S. policy. When someone mentioned to him that the constant building of new settlements goes contrary to Bush's roadmap, he says, we control Bush.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's no secret here. The secret is simply in this is not published or made prominent in the U.S. media. You've got someone like Rick Santorin, who's just a flunky of the Israeli state in pursuit of Philadelphia Jewish money.
We better believe it.
He wants to get a share of what Spector's been getting over the years.
Uh-huh.
In case he competes with them to see who's more pro-Israeli. And none of them are thinking of U.S. interests and the implications of kowtowing to Israel in terms of our bigger interests in the Middle East.
Right. Regarding the USS Liberty attack cover-up, we're very, very interested in this subject. We've interviewed several of the surviving crewmen and Admiral Starring as well. You say in your book that Washington acted as any third world country would when faced with an embarrassing attack by its hegemon. It silenced its own naval officers who witnessed the attack and quietly received compensation and a pro forma apology. James, what was the compensation?
The actual compensation was something like $2 million. It was a pittance. And they probably took it out of the $2.5 to $3 billion they get in USAID.
Right.
It wasn't even cigar money.
Yes.
And the main point is, of course, that President Johnson acted on behalf of the Israeli marauders rather than defending U.S. sailors.
Right.
And I think that is one of the major crimes of the Johnson administration, in addition to sacrificing 58,000 American soldiers in Indochina.
Yeah, that sinking of the Liberty was one of the great embarrassments of this nation. Now, James, in August of this year, I published a book called 9/11 Evil, where I show Israel's central role in the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Now, my question isn't whether you support this premise or not, but if people should be surprised by this involvement, considering Israel's long history of terrorism and spy operations.
Well, as I say, I have not seen any convincing evidence except the fact that the Israelis were on the tail of the people that later became involved in the 9/11. They had scores of spies in the United States. We do know recently that in Argentina, Israeli embassy official was stopped and it was found in his possession material to make bombs on his way to Chile.
Uh-huh.
So this is strange diplomatic pouch carrying in going from Argentina to Chile. What was he doing with bomb material? What were they trying to set up? situation where they could blame Hezbollah for setting off bombs in Chile.
Like they've done many other times.
Egypt, in the 50s, Israeli agents were caught putting bombs against the U.S. embassy. So they've been known to carry out provocations to blame their adversaries. And, of course, with the media acting on their behalf, they could make it stick. You can imagine National Public Radio getting in and saying, you know, suspected Arab terrorists were involved in blowing up a consular building in Chile. All fingers point, according to Israeli intelligence experts, that blah, blah, blah. And so we cannot rule out prima facie that Israel does not engage in terrorism against its allies in order to turn them against their adversaries. And I think one clear case is in my book about the cartoon. And that cartoon of Mohammed was put in that issue of that magazine by someone who's very close to the Israeli security apparatus and who had absolutely no qualifications to be a literary editor, as he presumed to be. And it was a lie that it was a contest, because the cartoons that he actually printed, including the one that he actually created the controversy, was by someone that he selected that was right on his own staff. And he most likely suggested it in the first place, knowing very well that it would have the effect that it would, and polarize Western Europe against the Israelis and make a phony issue of free speech, when it was really an attempt to provoke greater polarization and animosities.
For every dollar, you say, spent by the Jewish networks in influencing the voting outcomes, the Israeli state receives $50 in aid to finance the building and arming of settlements in the occupied territories, complete with swimming pools, Romanian gardeners, and Filipino maids. My question is this. If Israel didn't get the billions and billions of dollars that it gets in foreign aid, would it be able to self-sustain? Is it economically self-sufficient if the rest of the world didn't support it and prop it up?
Well, let's say Israel would exist, but at a much lower standard of living.
Right.
Many of the Russian emigres would probably move to Europe, as even some of them do now. And I think you'd get a more Yemenized and the North African Sephardic Jews in much more prominence in Israel, and many of the European Jews would go to Europe and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is that the territorial expansion would be cut back, or at least create tremendous conflicts between the remaining sums that go into the domestic economy versus the colonial settlements, and that's a controversy now. You can imagine if it's cut back by $5 or $6 billion, what a crisis that would present between the settler elements in Israel and the people that are trying to, the Jews trying to maintain some kind of a welfare state there. So I think it would lead to a sharp decline in settlements, in militarism, and a very large population emigration.
Yeah. Well, I want you to describe this concept, which you point out very well in your book. It's the concept of the Sionim, which is a network of Jews who are put in strategic places in a country who've agreed to help Mossad activities in that area. Explain the relevance of that term.
Well, it comes from a former Mossad agent who wrote a book on precisely the operations of the Mossad, and he mentions the Sayonarin as a essentially helpers of the Mossad. They are people that live in the country. They're not planted. They're auto dealerships. They have medical, they're doctors, dentists. Probably about 4,000 in the United States, according to Ostrowski. And when Mossad engages in an operation, they may provide a safe house, an occupied apartment building. If they're engaged in any kind of direct operation, a hit action, they might, if they got a used car dealer, provide an automobile. They may be owners of a travel agency and able to put together a travel plan to facilitate entry and exit. And if they're injured in any of their activities, they can certainly go to a doctor with no questions asked about any the source of any wounds. So it's a very important part of the Mossad support system. And as the Ostrowski's book points out, they're very important because the Mossad as an agency is not a huge apparatus. It has very specialized operators in it. It has its headquarters and training, but they count on these part-timers to carry on a lot of the support work that they need.
These are
people like French citizens or Dutch citizens or U.S. citizens that collaborators with the Mossad.
Right.
We know that not all Jewish people in Israel support the Israeli military machine, the Zionist war, the Zionist agenda. Why don't these Jews in Israel that oppose the military machine, why aren't they able to affect any change?
Well, because they're such a small minority. And second of all, when they are peacetime peaceniks, that is, they're against the war until the war happens, and then they rally around the flag, and then they pick up the banners of peace again. They're not consequential. Peace now, for example, is oppose all the wars until they happen, and then they find some rationale. Is the latest cliche is that these are existential moments or existential wars, whatever that means, and as if they're life-threatening or country-threatening wars in which the priority becomes survival over peace. And, of course, this is more hogwash. No one in their right mind considers Lebanon or even less Hezbollah a threat to Israel as a state. What they did was combat Israel's invasion of their country, and that, of course, is a wholly different thing. There are active anti-Zionists in Israel. It goes back to the famous theologian Martin Buber. There are today some professors in Israel that are critical of the Lebanon invasion. There are writers for Haaretz newspaper. I could send you the names of the two or three that actually exist. But as I say, the climate in Israel has moved further and further to the right, and the public opinion has, in fact, moved further to the right, and you'll find even in the government today, the Labor Kadima coalition has brought in a outright fascist in the coalition who calls for the expulsion of every single, not only Palestinian, mm-hmm. but Israeli Jew.
Right. Wow. Yeah. Well, James, I have one more question for you, but I want to let everybody know again. The name of the book is The Power of Israel in the United States by James Petras.
It's terrific.
It is an absolutely terrific book. It was just released, so this is up-to-date, current information. This isn't stuff that was written 20 years ago. This is published within the last month or so. An absolutely fascinating book, and as you could hear from James today,
and it's disturbing. It's very, very disturbing, and it's real.
Right. So my last question is, describe your disappointment with the reporting of such writers as Seymour Hersh and Noam Chomsky, who have a long history of denying and minimizing the power of the Israeli lobby in shaping the United States foreign policy
in the Middle East. In fact, a lot of the Zionists themselves deny the power they hold.
Well, C. Wright Mills, the famous sociologist, once said about the U.S. Power elite, he says their ideology is to deny they have power. It's just a democracy, pluralism. Each group has their own interest group. And so you have Wall Street and the local PTA competing for power. I mean, this was pure, unadulterated horse manure, as we used to say in up at the stables at Penn State. You might say that the denial is a way of protecting the power they have. And if you read the publications, however, of the major Jewish organizations, the president of the major American Jewish organizations, they boast about how much legislation they push through Congress. They boast about how much U.S. military and economic aid. It's all there. They list them in great detail, everything they've extracted from Congress and the U.S. taxpayer. So it's not as if you have to dig this out. I mean, all I did was go through all their records and their annual evaluations, and it's all written out for you. Now, the fact that Chomsky is blind to this, that he refuses to recognize that Israel gets 95% or 98% votes in handing out $3 or $4 billion to a country with a per capita income of $20,000 and a purchasing power of probably $26,000, you begin to wonder why Israel, a country with $20,000 per capita, is getting three-quarters of the aid in the U.S. and Africa and Asian poor countries, Bangladesh, Angola, Uganda, they get a pittance.
Right, right.
Exactly,
so
yeah.
You have to say that. Now, I want to add one thing. There's been a recent poll by Zogby that shows that over 50% of people between 18 and 28 years old believe that Israel was one of the main factors for the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a new generation, the young generation, who are not bamboozled by the Chomskyan rhetoric. You also find that 43% of all Democrats, liberals, believe that Israel was a factor in the U.S. war against Iraq. The problem is that these are silent majorities, silent pluralities.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is not only the media blockage on this, but the intimidation of the local Jewish organizations, the dentists and the doctors and the local lawyers who intimidate the local population, rant about anti-Semitism whenever this issue is about. I remember professors coming around and acting like little thugs till I threw them out of my office, and they raised this kind of rhetoric.
Yeah.
And I might add, my wife at the hospital, who she's a doctor, had one surgeon come in ranting about neo-fascism or neo-Nazism because she criticized the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. So you get this intimidation. A local columnist back 24 years ago attacked the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, and all the Jewish notables went to the press and tried to get him fired. He's never written another article critical of Israel since.
I believe. Well, yeah. Speaking of which, we remember those professors a couple months ago that released a paper and the heat that was brought upon them. James, have you felt any repercussions with your recent book, The Power of Israel in the United States?
Well, there'll be the usual claptrap about anti-Semitism and the scowls from pro-Israel clients, etc. But I'm tougher than they are, and they look for wimps to self-flagellate and apologize and say they really didn't mean it, etc. Well, I meant it, and they should know it.
Good for you.
We want everybody to know, too, this book does get into Israel's role in 9/11, and James has done some really good research on that subject, too. I wish we had more time today to get into that.
And, James, you should just be...
Well, my book is published by Clarity Press.
Uh-huh.
And it should be, by now, on Amazon.com.
All right, very good. Amazon.com, also wingtv.net. And, James, I just want you to know you should be extremely proud of what you've accomplished with this book. Because
we're proud of you.
I know we loved it, and just thank you for coming on Wing TV.
Okay, and thank you for having me. Look forward to hearing from you in the future.
Very well.
You will.
Bye.
We'll be back tomorrow on Wing TV. This really is
an excellent book, and I suggest everybody who's interested in this subject, who isn't afraid to address it and look it head on, check it out.
Exactly. We'll be back tomorrow on Wing TV. Until then, keep your eyes open, because there's a lot going on.
See you then.